Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And today, more than ever, the message of the show is what we're going to be focusing on in my conversation, because I am really so fortunate to be able to have with me as my guest, Dr. Peter McCullough, who is a renowned cardiologist, epidemiologist, and clinical professor of medicine at Texas A&M College of Medicine in Dallas, Texas. And we're going to be talking about what's really going on in the present time in regards to COVID, in regards to the concerns about children getting vaccines, in regards to this emerging Delta variant. And we're going to be talking about what we can do to keep ourselves healthy and sane during these crazy times. So first of all, I want to just introduce Dr. McCullough. In addition, as I said, as an internist, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and clinical professor of medicine at Texas A&M College of Medicine in Dallas, Dr. McCullough is an internationally renowned and recognized authority on the evaluation and practical application of medical evidence concerning contemporary issues in medicine. He has lectured on a broad range of health topics around the world and brings his experience into clinical focus for his patients on a daily basis. Dr. McCullough is known for his iconic views on the state of medical truth in America and around the globe, and pierces through the thin veil of mainstream media stories that skirt the major issues and provide no tractable basis for durable insight. The show, The McCullough Report, is heard on America Out Loud Network. And it's such an honor and a pleasure to have Dr. Peter McCullough with us today, because he is truly a beacon of light during times of great confusion, I must say, darkness. So, Dr. Peter McCullough, thank you so much for your time today and for your courage to be speaking out the truth.
Well, Cheryl, thanks for having me on the show.
So I've been looking forward to our conversation, because there's so much information swirling around, Dr. McCullough. There's so much fear that is being generated. I've had guests on my show trying to dispel the myths and misinformation, and we're going to really cut through so much of this today on this program. So I think we should start with the World Health Organization's recommendations not to give children any of these COVID vaccines, because I know that is being pushed at universities. So what's going on with that? Tell us the truth and what parents and everyone listening needs to know about vaccinating our children right now.
Well, it's June of 2021, and the overall public health bodies have not been helpful in terms of giving guidance on the vaccines. And what I mean by that is they haven't stuck to the randomized trials in terms of the inclusion-exclusion criteria. And they have, in my view, irresponsibly suggested vaccination for groups where the vaccine is clearly not studied and not shown to be safe. So that includes the World Health Organization, US FDA, the EMA in Europe, the MHRA in England, the CDC in the United States. And so as an example, all of them are permissive. In fact, the CDC is promotional of giving a vaccine to a pregnant woman, which pregnant women were specifically excluded because the FDA and the manufacturers knew that pregnant women and the babies could be harmed by the vaccine. And so those exclusion criteria were very well set up in the clinical trial. So we already had malfeasance or wrongdoing by our government agencies. I think pregnant women was the most glaring example. Now the sights have been set on the children. And I think largely because of vaccine marketing, because of the idea that adults can make their own decisions, but children can be much more swayed by peer pressure and by parental pressure. And already the vaccine stakeholders were meeting considerable resistance among adults. Adults started seeing the data coming out on the vaccine, the safety data, and immediately the vaccine centers started dropping in terms of subscription. So I have analyzed the data. And I believe as of May 27th, I gave the country my official recommendation May 27th after the Pfizer age 12 to 15 data came out showing no clinical benefit in children that age and showing really horrendous safety data. There was 60-80% of kids were really sick after the vaccine, high fevers to 40 degrees. 35% of them needed parents to give them Tylenol and take them out of school. They had muscle aches, joint aches. So the vaccine, the New England Journal of Medicine paper on May 27 from Pfizer, in my interpretation is that vaccine trial was a complete bust. The conclusions by the authors was, oh, it worked fine. It was terrific. The conclusions by the U.S. FDA was approved, emergency use authorized, approved in that age group. And then immediately they started to be a solicitation in commercials on TV to vaccinate children that age. Well, the World Health Organization came out, I believe on June 3rd, with a statement saying, you know, they don't think it's too wise to vaccinate individuals under age 18. And then there's been some instability with respect to their statements. And I heard in the last 24 hours that they've had a reversal of that statement on the website or changed it back to just acknowledging that Pfizer's EUA on this. But it's showing you that we have a propagandized program for vaccination, and there's instability in the stakeholders who are exercising the propaganda.
And, you know, unless you go to the right channels and the right outlets, most people are not aware of what is happening to these children who have been vaccinated. Can you share what you are hearing or maybe even seeing in your practice? I don't know if you've seen any of these children yet, but the serious, and not only serious and life-threatening conditions and myocarditis and all these other health issues, but also death for some of these children.
Parents have never been faced with this proposition of having their child vaccinated for a problem that doesn't really involve children, where COVID-19 is not a serious threat to children. It can always be treated with medications if the situation occurred where a child did have severe symptoms, or let's say there was a child with cystic fibrosis or pulmonary disease. That child could always be treated with the standard medicines we use to treat COVID-19 that are safe and effective. So the only way a child could ever get in trouble would be to get severe case of COVID and not get early treatment. But nowadays, the early treatment protocols are there. So it's a completely treatable problem for which we would never need to give a vaccine. So first off, it's just COVID's not an issue. Many of the children are already immune. And then the safety reports are extraordinary. So under the emergency use authorization, we'll just restrict the conversation to the United States. The CDC says in the consent form, if the parents look at the consent form, the consent form says, we don't know if this vaccine is going to work. We don't know if it lasts more than 2 months. And we don't know if it's safe. And the side effects can be anything from a sore arm all the way to death. That's what the consent form says. That's what the parents are signing up for their child. We have, as of today, in the CDC vaccine adverse event reporting system, in the consent form, it tells the parents, go to VAERS, go to VAERS, and look at the safety data yourself, because the CDC and the manufacturers are not going to keep up with this. It's our job to go to VAERS. So your listeners should know, as of June 11, 2021, in terms of certified and vetted reports, it just doesn't include the preliminary reports. These are ones that the CDC says are real. There's 358,379 reports that have come in. We know 80% are filed by doctors and nurses and certified healthcare personnel who think the vaccine caused it. 5,993 deaths, 20,737 hospitalizations, 47,837 urgent care visits, 65,623 office visits, 1,538 anaphylaxis visits, and 1,868 cases of Bell's palsy or paralyzation of the face on one side. And I'm not going to read off the countless other events, including heart attacks, myocarditis, neurologic injury, et cetera. So people say, well, gosh, those are big numbers, but there's been a lot of people vaccinated. How can we put this into an interpretable framework? If you look at all 70 vaccines on the U.S. market, we probably administer a billion shots a year in the United States. I know myself, I have already taken two vaccines this year. If we look at all the vaccines per year, there are approximately 16,000 safety reports filed. And again, with COVID-19, it's 358,000. So it's many-fold greater. But the deaths that occur due to vaccines, all vaccines combined per year, about 25. So this is staggering to have 5,993 deaths after COVID-19 vaccination, and they occur on days 1, 2, and 3 in the majority of people. Now, the CDC says the vaccine doesn't directly cause the deaths, but vignettes say is that the vaccine led to the allergic reaction where the patient died, or the vaccine led to the heart attack or heart inflammation or the blood clot and the patient died. So the vaccine is in the causal pathway to causing the death. On Monday of this week, Laura Ingram, on the Ingram Angle, she had me on as a guest, and she just read one of the vignettes. It was a 13-year-old boy. He took the vaccine. He got heart inflammation called myocarditis, which has occurred in hundreds and hundreds of children, and his heart swelled, and he died. It's just as clear as that. It's just as clear as this. So parents are being encouraged to take their children in to get a vaccine they don't need for an illness that isn't going to bother them, and then they're dying after the vaccine, or they're having catastrophic problems, blood clots in their brain, neurologic damage, being hospitalized. It is absolutely a train wreck, and the only way to stop is for the parents to say, no, we're not doing this. No, just the parents. It is as biblical and Old Testament as we can get, that parents must protect their children. And in this case, the parents cannot trust, and they cannot allow any government propagandized program to influence the safety of their children. They cannot.
Yeah, I hardly have words to even express the shock, the horror. It's incomprehensible that we are putting an experimental vaccine, we'll call it a vaccine, into the bodies of young children. Of course, they're wanting to do children younger and younger. That's also in the plan. Because this vaccine is supposedly accomplishing what, Dr. McCullough? You know, let's go back to one of the basic questions. What is this supposed vaccine going to do when it's injected into our children?
You know, I have to tell you, in the last year, I think I've done a fellowship in virology and vaccine medicine. I felt compelled to do that as a clinical scholar. I'm considered one of the strongest people in my field or in medicine, and I did not see high-quality scholarship being done. And so I work with thousands of people across the world. I've reviewed thousands and thousands of reports, and I learn from people all over. So a prominent pathologist from Canada just this morning revealed some documents to us concerning lipid nanoparticles. And the first author of the manuscript is Meirin, M-E-I-R-I-N, and it was from the Serum Research Institute in France. And the paper was published about 15 years ago. And these lipid nanoparticles were tagged with immunofluorescence, injected into animals' bodies, and they showed dramatic uptake into the ovaries. In fact, the ovaries lit up, and the ovaries seemed to be very avid in taking up these lipid nanoparticles, and the ovaries outshined all the other organs. In fact, they were so avid that when they sacrificed the animals and opened up the pelvis and the abdomen, the ovaries literally glowed, and they have a picture of this in the paper. So it was known 15 years ago, if we took lipid nanoparticles, they were going to go to the ovaries. That was known. And we fast forward, and Pfizer and Moderna have messenger RNA products that are packaged in lipid nanoparticles. Both those companies, Pfizer and Moderna and the FDA, either knew or should have known that the messenger RNA was going to be delivered to the ovaries. And the message that was put out initially was that the vaccines stay in the arm, that these are messenger RNA products, they're in lipid nanoparticles, and they stay in the arm, and that's all that's going to happen. Well, within a month or two, we realized they can't be staying in the arm because radiologists were noticing in women that the breast on that side of the injection, the breast was becoming very abnormal on the mammograms. And the breast became so distorted with inflammation and changes in the breast tissue and the adjacent lymph nodes that there was a warning that went out that said, listen, if you've had the vaccine, don't get a mammogram for the next year. So we knew that those the messenger RNA and lipid nanoparticles was on the move in the body. And then Ogata from Harvard about a month ago found the ability to measure the spike protein that's generated by cells once they take up the messenger RNA. And sure enough, Ogata was able to demonstrate circulating spike protein 2 weeks after the first shot. It wasn't measurable after the second shot, probably because the antibody squashed it. So when we put this all together, it looks like the lipid nanoparticles go to female ovaries. The ovaries take up the messenger RNA, and they start producing the spike protein. The spike protein is the spicule, or the spine, on the ball of the virus. The spike protein is the product of gain-of-function research that was done in the Wuhan virology laboratory. The spike protein was made particularly dangerous. It's dangerous within cells, and it causes cell destruction, but it's very dangerous when it gets on the cell surface and then actually pokes through and goes into blood vessels and starts damaging blood vessels, causing blood clots, and traveling to the brain, the heart, the other organs. We also know the lipid nanoparticles and the messenger RNA deposits now in the brain and the heart directly. So this is like a science experiment that's just gone bad. We would never allow our own bodies to produce a dangerous pathogenic protein, let alone a protein that's a product of gain-of-function research. It's the most diabolical thought we could ever have, that we're now injecting ourselves and tricking our bodies into making a genetically modified spike protein in order to try to gain some immunity out of it. It's almost like a science experiment you'd watch in an Avengers movie or something like that.
What do you speculate would happen to women who have had young girls, this vaccination, this shot, whatever you want to call it, to their ovaries? What do you speculate would happen if ovaries are taking up this nanoparticles and the spike protein and the whole thing? What are your concerns?
Well, on face value, the lipid nanoparticles have polyethylene glycol. And the polyethylene glycol is a substance in radiator fluid. It's called PEG or polyethylene glycol. And so the first thing is, one would never want any foreign substance to get into the ovaries. I don't care what it is. So this is a synthetic lipid nanoparticle with polyethylene glycol. Just the idea of anything getting in the ovaries like this is a bad idea. The ovaries are a unique special organ. They have hormonal regulatory control over the female body. They clearly produce eggs or ovum. And what the groups have shown actually 15 years ago is that nanoparticles get into the corpus luteum. So they actually influence the hormonal aspects of the ovaries almost certainly. And we knew this early on once the vaccines rolled out, women started to complain of changes in their menstrual periods. And there was lots of anecdotal reports of this. There were reports that came in about even postmenopausal women starting to have vaginal bleeding. And then the shoe started to drop when the manuscripts came in. So there's one manuscript in pregnancy, for instance, which we would think that injecting a foreign substance with polyethylene glycol and a lipid nanoparticle and messenger RNA to inject that into a pregnant woman, where the FDA thought it was dangerous, Pfizer and Moderna thought it was dangerous, that we would never do that in clinical practice. I mean, you could think about, there absolutely positively should have been a wall put up and saying pregnant women may not take this vaccine. You know, we believed it was dangerous when we did the clinical trials. We have all the reason in the world to believe it's dangerous. But yet In fact, the opposite has been done in almost a diabolical manner. And in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was a paper published about outcomes in pregnant women. And because no woman was followed for 9 months, because we haven't had 9 months of experience with the vaccines, we only have snapshots. My interpretation of this, and we filed a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, was that the fetal loss rate in the first trimester was over 80%. And other experts agree with me. The analysis that was taken was trying to evaluate just the women that went all the way to term, and they came up with a completely different number. But the point is, it looks like it's honestly, quite frankly, just dangerous to mother and baby in pregnancy. And in the women who take the vaccine and the young girls who take the vaccine, these changes in menstrual periods are probably a harbinger of what could be anything ranging from ovulatory malfunction, hormonal malfunction, menstrual irregularities. And then the worst possibility is if the spike protein directly causes enough cell damage in ovaries or damages the blood supply to the ovaries locally, that we can end up with sterilization or problems with fertility. And we had a hint of that in the Moderna application to the European medicine agencies, where they did disclose a fertility study done in animals. And lo and behold, over a very short period of time, the vaccine dropped fertility in laboratory animals. The value that it was dropped by was a relative 16%. 25% would have been the line of which the vaccines wouldn't have moved forward because of concerns on dropping fertility in women. But at 16%, it was allowed to go forward. So if you put all this together, if you said, Dr. McCullough, do you anticipate these vaccines will lead to ovarian failure, hormonal and regulatory failure over the uterus, and could they lead to problems with fertility in the future? I would say absolutely yes.
Well, and we don't know. It may create all sorts of other problems, you know, maybe increasing all sorts of other chronic health conditions in women once you start messing with the ovaries and estrogen production and everything else that's involved. We don't know. That's the point. We don't know. And the point is we not only don't know, but we're doing something that is experimental and for something that is a condition that is unnecessary to have such drastic treatments because we can treat it naturally and it doesn't occur very seriously or very often in the young. I mean, the whole scenario, check every box, it's, you know, inane, right? It's an inane decision and a dangerous one. There's no positive about giving our children this vaccine.
Well, there's no positive in actually giving anybody under age 50 the vaccine. I would extend it all the way up to age 50. I've kind of outlined for America at least a dividing line on 30, because that's where we're seeing this direct heart inflammation, and at least the CDC is acknowledging that. This week they're having emergency meetings on the heart inflammation that occurs immediately within 2 days of the vaccine in predominantly young men, but it has happened in young women. It's obviously led to deaths, heart failure. I've seen these patients in my practice. It's very real. And at least they're acknowledging that. That goes up to age 30. But when you evaluate risks and benefits, it's a rare person under 50 who could even possibly benefit from the vaccine. And now that we see every day what we learn about the vaccines is something bad. There isn't a single good thing that we've learned. We have seen changes in the breasts of women, now the ovarian targeting. We've seen blood disorders. We've seen the fact that the vaccine distributes everywhere. The messenger RNA is in the brain. It's in the organs. It doesn't digest or go away like we thought. Now, there was an autopsy study from Germany where a month afterwards that, in fact, it was everywhere. It was really almost sickening to see where this stuff goes in the body. And then to make matters worse, the vaccines don't work. And so patients still get COVID anyway. So the CDC had over 10,000 breakthrough cases up until May 31st, and they were overwhelmed. They gave up. They said, we can't track this anymore. And they, I think, very disingenuously took that 10,000 and divided by the number of people vaccinated and say, well, it's really rare. Well, they didn't check all the other people vaccinated to see if they got COVID. It was just 10,000 that got pushed forward to them. There's been another 4,000 that's come forward since that time. So by the thousands, people are getting COVID anyway. In the UK, they are readily reporting large numbers of breakthrough cases. It looks like the vaccine doesn't work, and if it does, its effect is very modest.
And I think that's a point I just want to say with that the belief is, the promotion, I've heard all sorts of people in the media who are pushing the vaccine or intimating it's going to protect you from getting this virus. But in actual fact, that never was the purpose of this, of these shots. They never were designed to stop you from getting or transmitting. As far as I've been told, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're only supposed to lessen symptoms at a small degree.
Well, the vaccine efficacy rates from the trials were calculated on a clinical case of COVID. So someone having some characteristic features, fever, nasal stuffiness, and a positive COVID test. That was the endpoint. And they did reduce that endpoint, but it was very rare in both placebo and the vaccine groups. All the trials amazingly recruited patients that had less than 1% chances of getting COVID. So they found some of the cleanest populations ever. And basically, people didn't get COVID in the clinical trial. So way below 1%, sure, the vaccine was better than placebo, but the absolute risk reduction is less than 1%. And so that's what we have to apply to populations. So people have asked me, Dr. McCullough, if we vaccinate everybody, isn't that going to solve the problem? And the answer is no, because the absolute risk reduction is less than 1%. That means as vaccines have no chance of influencing these COVID epidemic curves, no chance at all.
Oh, gosh. So, okay, I think that's a really important point that needs to be emphasized, and because the whole basis of pushing this campaign is invalid, really. It's flawed. And what we're doing is setting up populations around the world to be seriously compromised, to make them more vulnerable to a variety of health, serious health or life-threatening conditions, to threat the health and well-being of our children and their fertility. It's just staggering when you get the truth, and that's why we're having this conversation, because we don't hear these conversations go on everywhere. They're censored, they're denied. So I want to move on to the parents who are really concerned about the universities that are mandating vaccines to these 17, 18-year-olds. What do parents need to do? What can they do to protect their children?
It is unprecedented that universities, and it turns out about a little under 10% of universities have put out threatening or intimidating messages regarding the COVID-19 vaccine. And what I mean by that is it's typically some type of email or an FAQ that says you have to get the COVID-19 vaccine. The vast majority of these universities actually do not have a written policy. And any organization that has rules, like universities and hospitals, what have you, they must have a policy. And the policy has to be voted upon and ratified. And then all policies have to have fair exemption processes. So the universities haven't done this. It's interesting. It's almost an attempt of the universities to assault the students and the parents with intimidation. And, universities should not be in this business. Most of them have had a year off in terms of having their facilities closed. The teachers haven't shown up. Students haven't been in class. It's interesting. Most students actually stayed in the college towns, and they took their classes by WebEx, and they went out to the bars and afterwards, and they played basketball and softball. So for the kids, all the social stuff was the same. And the what happened last year was purely for the professors. And interestingly, most of the colleges that have these are using these intimidation tactics, which are really offensive. There isn't a single parent that I know of that has thought that these are a good thing or that they welcomed them. People are just assaulted by these. That many of these universities, the professors aren't taking the vaccine. And the vaccine stakeholders in the United States, the CDC, the NIH, and the FDA, they're not taking the vaccine either. So this propagandized, socially weaponized, biologically dangerous product, the vaccine now, is being, in a sense, just levered right at college kids. So what do we know? We know that, for instance, colleges do have, by policy, they do have vaccine that is recommended. For instance, the meningococcal vaccine is recommended when the kids go off to college. And every parent recognizes this. We get our kids the meningococcal vaccine. There's 20 million kids that go off to college. Zero deaths. Zero deaths. Perfectly safe vaccine. Who wouldn't accept that? And parents accept it. So it's not as if parents and students are anti-vax. It's just we need to promote safe vaccines. The COVID-19 vaccine is not tested. It's not safe. And the consent form says experimental. So the legal questions are, how in the world can, you know, 9% of colleges threaten and intimidate students and parents and force them to participate in vaccine research against their will without having a fair exemption process? So we know that Indiana University's got a major case that lead attorney Jim Bopp is leading. He was on Tucker Carlson explaining the case in the last week or so. We know that there are cases all over. Parents can certainly write their universities, and every single parent should be peppering the inboxes of the harassment and the harassment and ombudsman sites. You know, if there was sexual harassment or other behavioral harassment, parents wouldn't hesitate to defend their kids on that. They wouldn't even bat an eye if there was a female student and she was sexually harassed with comments and things like that. They would absolutely positively file a complaint. So I think every parent and student should be peppering all the complaint inboxes, saying, listen, I don't agree with this. I don't, you know, I don't feel comfortable with it. And then they can go to the Department of Education Office of the Inspector General Civil Rights Complaints, and I'll send you the link. And on this, they can actually file a civil rights complaint against the university for intimidation and harassment, which is what it is. It's a form of intimidation. And as students and parents push back on this, these legal mandates and these court cases, universities are responding with more intimidation. Some universities have said, okay, you can come on campus, but you have to wear a mask and you have to pay several thousand dollars more in fees. And so for some reason, the vaccine has institutionally brought out the worst in people. We have done the estimates. We know that without the vaccine, we're not going to have any harm done. And with college students with the vaccine, the estimates are we'll have 40 college kids killed and we'll have 1,000 hospitalized. And so what parents are wondering is, you know, is the genetic dice going to roll for my child, and am I going to lose my child this year? Some have said, listen, until cooler heads prevail, that they're just going to transfer to other schools. And I can tell you in Texas, we have all of our major schools have no vaccine mandates, and we have four very small private schools that have vaccine mandates, and they're getting absolutely pounded and shelled. I think there's OIG complaints against every one of them. And so we'll have to see how this pans out. But it is absolutely the most ill-fated, poorly conceived move that universities could ever do. And it's abhorrent, this idea of levering a dangerous biologic substance in research onto students who have no benefit and the professors won't take it.
So this is so illogical. Just what do you surmise is behind this mandating? It's so illogical on so many fronts that something is driving this behavior and these decisions. What do you think it is?
What I've seen in the last year since the whole start of this, because COVID-19 affected 1% of the population, had way less than a 1% mortality. We found out we could treat it and we could stop 85% of these hospitalizations and deaths. I think from the very beginning, it was propagandized. From the very beginning, from having a death scoreboard up on all the news stations, from the immediate suppression of accurate information, suppression of any information on treatment, over-testing, creating more fear, unnecessary lockdowns, unnecessary restrictions. Obviously, the schools and colleges never needed to close. I can tell you in Dallas, for instance, there was wonderful social experiments. The Dallas Independent School Systems closed down, and the kids were, you know, free to roam around or try to join by WebEx. We got 40% of seniors not ready to graduate, and the private schools never shut down. The private schools met every day. They had in-school classes. There were no school outbreaks. Even the Trump administration brought in Scott Atlas from Stanford, someone who I've been communicating with, and Scott went on and said that, listen, don't close down the schools. It doesn't need to happen. There were never any school outbreaks. The professors could always be protected. We should never close down the schools. So the schools somehow became a vanguard for something that became propagandized, became socially weaponized, and now the vaccine has come in as just an absolute offensive weapon. And no one is happy about this. I don't think anybody is cheering for these university administrators. And so I see only bad things to happen for these board of governors, these deans, provosts, the hospital, the university presidents, and the deaths of these kids, which mathematically is going to happen. You vaccinate 20 million college kids, there are going to be clear deaths right after the vaccine. The civil cases that will arise. Now, we know that the vaccine manufacturers are indemnified, the vaccine centers are indemnified, but the entity that forces the person into vaccination, and that's what these policies are. They simply look at the policy and say, was this coercive, or the email, or the FAQ, and we'll say, yeah, for sure, they were coercing the kids. Then the entity that does the coercion becomes responsible in a wrongful death lawsuit, a civil lawsuit. And so these civil lawsuits will probably be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to these families. And so these universities that are flush with cash, they've had no operational expenses for a year, they've shut down their buildings, they've collected tuition, now they're going to pay it out in these expensive legal cases. I mean, it's a mathematical reality. Nothing is being done to make these vaccines safer. If we're stuck with Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, the deaths are going to happen. Now, there is a bright spot. There's a much safer vaccine that's coming along by Novavax. They released their top-line results last week. It's just as good as Pfizer and Moderna, and it's way safer. No serious safety things at all. It doesn't use any genetic trickery. It's just an antigen vaccine. It's almost like a flu shot, much more well-tolerated. So if people were so hungry for a vaccine and they said, listen, we can wait for a safer vaccine, I'd say you can do that. I still wouldn't have anybody under age 50 get the vaccine. I would use it in seniors or other high-risk people. Or maybe the professors wanted to take Novavax. That'd be fine. But not the kids.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for that. That's so profound. And I appreciate that insight. I wanted to ask you also about the other topic that is getting a lot of press, and that is the so-called Delta variant. And I see that everywhere on the media. It's, you know, ratcheting up the fear, which obviously will lead to more vaccinations or more booster shots. We don't really know. So tell us, what do you know about this Delta variant? How dangerous is it? Should we be scared? Should we take action? What's the truth about this new situation?
Well, many of the listeners would recognize I've become a regular contributor to the Ingram Angle, Laura Ingram, at night. And so this week I was specifically asked on this, and I upgraded and updated America on the renaming of the different variants. So the original coronavirus, the original COVID-19 virus, was called the wild type Wuhan. It's the one that came out of the lab, the one that was genetically created. That was the original strain. That's long gone. We haven't had that in America in a long time. Last time I checked, we had about 14 different variants in the United States. The most common one was the British variant. But every time these mutations happen, the virus gets weaker and it becomes less deadly. And that term That process is called Mueller's Ratchet. So I educated Laura Ingram to use Mueller's Ratchet. And so she took the bold step of saying this. And in fact, Mueller's Ratchet is the way a virus gets past an evolutionary bottleneck and survives. So the mutants have been renamed. So your viewers should know that the alpha variant is the United Kingdom variant. That's the most common in the United States right now. The beta is the South African variant. The gamma is the Brazilian variant. And now the delta is actually the Indian variant. It came out of India. All the previous ones, alpha, beta, and gamma, were single mutations. The delta variant is a triple mutation. It mutated three times, and it has one little additional fold in it after it's produced. And this variant is more contagious, but it's less lethal. And in the United Kingdom, they have they release a statistical report on the variants. They've released 16 of these, where they've sequenced hundreds of thousands of people, and they know if they've died or not. So it's the best source of information out there. And I basically read to America the data from the UK variants of concern report, indicating that it's less of a worry than even the current COVID-19 that we have in the United States. It's almost like a common cold at this point in time. So the Delta variant, while it will become predominant, it went from 2% to 98% in the UK. Right now it's 2% in the United States, and it will go to 90% in the United States. I'm convinced of it. But it's now basically burning out like the common cold. You can almost think of COVID-19 like a hurricane, and it really, really ripped hard, but over time it becomes less intense. And it's just going to be a less intense illness. It absolutely positively is no reason for fear. It's no reason to go have kids vaccinated. It's going to be like the common cold. So if you do get COVID-19 now, it's a lot less deadly than getting it a year ago.
And that is such a different message, isn't it, than what is being purveyed in the media. It's so incredible that that we are really being denied the truth in these circumstances. And just generating the fear that is obviously encouraging people to take the risk of getting the vaccinations.
Well, that's the reason why, Cheryl, people are seeking your podcast, and they are seeking these other sources of information. It's now explicit. I mean, the major media through the Trusted News Initiative announced December 10th, and then YouTube and Twitter and all the social media, they've come out and basically said, listen, we are not going to give fair information. We are only going to promote the vaccine. And anything on treatment, anything that gives information on fair balance on safety on the vaccine is going to be suppressed. So they've actually been fair to the public. They are telling us, listen, this is a propaganda thing. This is an effort to get a needle in every arm. They're very explicit about this. And I think viewers understand it. In fact, when someone gets kicked off of Twitter, like a doctor, a prominent doctor gets kicked off Twitter, then they start getting massive numbers of followers and people seeking them out because they know that they're a source of truth. And even people working in the social sphere, for instance, that were actually on the right track, and they get permanently suspended, they become iconic because people follow them. So Naomi Wolf comes up as someone on the sociology part. She's got a PhD in sociology, former CNN contributor. Martin Kulldorff from Harvard. There was a group that I was involved in called COVID-19 Treatments that was followed. We were the senatorial initial group that presented the data for the Senate hearings. That's been permanently banned from Twitter. And the these sources of information where, you know, that's how we are communicating, people have been scrubbed off social media intentionally. And they've been very clear about this. Because we're bringing accurate and correct information forward, we're being scrubbed. The only thing that's going to be put forward is going to be propagandized information that is wrong and is incorrect and is all oriented towards promoting the vaccine. This is explicit now. So I think people know the Delta variant is being propagandized to try to scare people into getting the vaccine. the people doing it are honest about it. They say, listen, we're doing this to promote the vaccine.
Well, we can go in all sorts of directions, but I want to get to some practical recommendations that you have, Dr. McCaw. And I want to start with your thoughts on what people who have already been vaccinated and have some vulnerabilities because of that vaccination should be doing to protect their health. What are you recommending to your patients and to people in general?
Okay. Well, in the few minutes we have left, because I have to leave at the top of the hour, what I would say is this, is that, we know that about half of Americans patriotically got vaccinated. The vast majority of people got vaccinated did it because they were trying to follow the rules. They had good intentions. 70% of people in my practice were vaccinated in December, January, and February. I thought it was a good thing, too, until I started seeing the data. But what we know now is that it should just stop. I think categorically, no one under age 30, and only on a special case above age 30 should it ever be considered. It would be a rare patient now that I would endorse vaccination. I mean, maybe I'd find somebody with cystic fibrosis or emphysema or just some special case where COVID would not be survivable, would I suggest it. I don't suggest the vaccine for even elderly seniors because those are the ones who seem to die so readily with the production of the spike protein. So I know people are in their 90s. I said, listen, I don't think you can survive the vaccine. I don't think they can survive COVID, but I don't think they can survive the vaccine. I think the good news is they can probably wait for a safer vaccine, and the Novavax appears to be the initial solution to this. So I think we're really going to welcome that when it comes through. The other thing that Novavax is being discussed as the universal booster. So we may get away from the genetic vaccines, which are Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, and just have a Novavax booster, and that actually may be okay. For those individuals who think they've had a vaccine injury, and the toughest one are the neurologic injuries where there's been a change in brain function, those individuals, I think, ought to have a medical evaluation. They should prompt the healthcare doctors to report this to the CDC. They should do their own report if the doctor refuses to do that, and they should get a workup. And that involves brain MRI imaging. We know that blood clots can form in the brain. They can be tricky to diagnose. Individuals with vaccine injuries need evaluations, and they should demand it. They should say, listen, I've got a vaccine injury. So many patients actually are sheepish about this. They almost feel embarrassed that that something's happened. And say, listen, don't blame yourself. Everyone thought this was okay. Now we're starting to realize it's like a science experiment that's gone wrong. So they should seek an evaluation. I think at this point in time, there should be no boosters with Pfizer, Moderna, or J&J. That's just asking for problems because every time we rejazz the system with this synthetic genetic material, whether it's the messenger RNA or the adenoviral DNA, it looks like it's a disaster.
So I have one last question. I know you're going to have to take off in a minute. If the variants are getting weaker and weaker, so they're less deadly, they may be more contagious, so you may get more of a cold, but it's not going to be life-threatening, why do we need any more vaccinations? Why do we need a Novavax if this is as dangerous as the common cold?
Well, you make a very good point. There was a paper in New England Journal of Medicine that looked at nursing home patients. Remember, this whole thing started out, the real people who were clobbered were the nursing home patients, and we had tremendous loss of life. We have 2.7 million nursing home residents in the United States. We lost hundreds of thousands of them to the virus. They clearly got the infection from the nursing home workers. I mean, that was well documented in the studies from Washington State in California. So one could say, listen, if there were any nursing home patients that still weren't covered by the vaccine and we had a safe vaccine, we could almost make this a standard just so this would never happen again, like a flu shot. That would be pretty reasonable, I would say. But in this New England Journal of Medicine paper, as I recall, there was 13,000 nursing home patients who got one of the vaccines, and there was about 3,000 patients who didn't get the vaccines. And they were followed over the course of the spring, and you know what? COVID burned out in both groups, and COVID never came back, whether you got the vaccine or not. So you make a valid point that maybe we're just honestly on the back end of this epidemic, and we can just stop all this
hardship that's been put on the population by just stopping the vaccine altogether. If tomorrow the United States government shut down the vaccine program and they were shut down worldwide, honestly, I think overall we'd be better off. We just have to be prepared to treat COVID-19. And there are calls. The evidence-based consulting group in England, which is the lead advisor to the World Health Organization, they have advised to the MHRA in the UK to shut down the program altogether. And their report says, it says the vaccines are not safe for human use, period, full stop. Stop the program. We have, as we speak today, we have citizens' petitions into the U.S. FDA. Do not approve these. They're not safe for use into the U.S. FDA. We have demand letters into the CDC to recognize natural immunity. We should definitely never vaccinate somebody who's naturally immune. There's no opportunity for benefit, and 3 studies show excess harm. We have that into the CDC. We have demand letters into the World Health Organization. It's not as if we're not doing anything. It's just that this has become a runaway, propagandized, very dangerous time in history. Never have I seen any population risk put in such a grand scale as this. Can you imagine 300,000 Americans seriously injured by an investigational vaccine with no apologies, no attempt to make it safer, no safeguards, no independent review committees, no advisory committees, no ethics committees, in a runaway, propagandized program? It is astonishing.
And if we could now encourage the use of vitamin D and zinc and vitamin C and just some good nutrition as this variant weakens, we can certainly support the immune systems of everyone of all ages as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'd absolutely agree with that. And I think we'll let that be the last word. Health and nutrition play a giant role in helping us through the pandemic. And I want to thank you so much for having me on the show.
And what is the best website, Dr. McCullough, for people to go to?
They can go to America Out Loud, the McCullough Report. And we have updates, okay. And everything I have in there is completely evidence-based. We have the citations in the literature and the appropriate links. And I bring on the best experts all over the world. I bring on, if there's going to have a topic about pregnancy and vaccination, I'm going to have obstetricians and people who evaluate women for fetal loss on the show. And I go through their medical credentials at the start each and every time because I want the listeners to understand that this is a really high-quality source of audio information. And you see people walking around your neighborhoods with earbuds in and what have you all the time, and that's how people are getting their information nowadays. And honestly, you just can't turn on the TV right now and get a fair view of what's going on.
And I want to thank you. And on behalf of America, Dr. McCullough, we thank you. Bless you. Have
okay.
a great day.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye now.